Morning, folks. We want to be able to get started. Congressman Blumenauer has a hearing that he needs to open on the House side at 10 o'clock. And since he's the chairman, now they will wait for him, but it's not appropriate to keep everybody waiting. So we do want to get started. We're fortunate to have him here. Let me just say, first of all, welcome. Thank you all for coming. My name is John Hamley. I'm the president at CSIS. We have been interested in trying to push for a water agenda for America for a long time. I do it for a very selfish reason. America's reputation around the world is in a hole. Nothing would more propel us back to being a respected leader than if America were to take the lead in providing for every human being on the planet within 10 years clean and safe drinking water. Nothing would do more than that. And so to have a chance to bring all of you together to listen to real leaders, leaders like Congressman Blumenauer, is a great opportunity for us. This is World Water Week. Hopefully that the world's going to spend a little bit more time and attention thinking about this enormous issue. So we are pleased that all of you can come. Congressman, I just want to say thank you for you've pioneered unpopular issues since you've been in the Congress. You've taken the lead at a time when it wasn't popular. Maybe the winds are shifting and there's now a consciousness that makes the issues that you have personally championed now recognized as being important for America. It's not always pleasant being a pioneer when no one's following you, but now the world wants to follow. We're delighted that you're here. We know that you have to leave shortly. Let me ask you to come forward. Say a few words to our group. Thank you. Congressman Lloyd Blumenauer, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. There are those that would say that I pioneered unpopular issues that were only unpopular after I finished pioneering them, but not so dealing with water. Because I must say, nothing in the 40 years now that I've been involved in the political process has given me greater satisfaction than working with so many of you in areas of safe drinking water and sanitation. It has been exciting to watch the commitment grow, to watch churches and synagogues and Girl Scout troops and Rotary clubs across America understanding the role that individuals can play in making sure that some of the world's neediest people have access to what we too often take for granted. It was exciting to watch in Johannesburg 7 years ago, where the United Nations Millennium Challenge goals focused on water and sanitation. It was great fun to work with a number of you on the passage of the Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act. I am wearing my, thank you, Patty, I'm wearing my Paul Simon Memorial bow tie this morning. And to watch how at a time where in our nation's capital, you may have noticed occasionally there's a little bit of dissension, disagreement, a little bit. But with the Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act, my partner in the House was Chairman Henry Hyde, and in the Senate, we were joined by the leaders of the two parties, Harry Reid and Bill Frist, to be able to navigate something through Congress at a time when people were being a little cranky. It is also true that the progress that we all hoped for has been less than overwhelming. We're getting pretty good at setting the right goals, being able to make the case, but the actual performance on the ground, shall we say, leaves a little bit to be desired. Remember, as we were fighting to get $50 million from the Appropriations Committee, I have a lot of respect for those folks, but in a typical morning, they'll spill more than that. We, in 1 year, it was less than $10 million for all of sub-Saharan Africa. Frustrating. Because we still have half the people today who are sick around the world, sick needlessly from waterborne disease. course of the visit here this morning, more than 300 children will die needlessly from waterborne disease. But I do think that we have turned the corner with the help of so many of you here in this room. I'm optimistic about the commitment of the new administration to back up the rhetoric with action. We're already seeing that, and part of what we're going to be fighting for on the budget committee this week is keeping that 150 funds intact. I've had a very encouraging exchange with Secretary of State Clinton, who I think gets it, and working with the administration, things can happen. Chair Anita Lowy, every time she passes me in the hall, goes, water, water, water. But $300 million is an encouraging start. And in a moment, you're going to hear from one of the real giants of the Senate, Senator Dick Durbin, the successor to Paul Simon, a friend and an admirer of Paul Simon, is, you know, kind of the right person at the right time to be a Senate champion. It's not just that Senator Durbin really shares the values of Paul Simon, which he does, but he has one of the most infectious wits of anybody in the Senate and can kind of disarm, that he is the second-ranking Democrat in the majority. He's respected, smart, principled. He has a reasonably good relationship with the administration, with his former colleague in the Senate, Barack Obama, and he was one of the first supporters of the president. But more than that, Senator Durbin understands how these pieces fit together. So I am tremendously encouraged with the administration, with what's happening around the world, with the foundation that you all have participated in. We do need to take a step back, though, and not let anybody forget the magnitude of the challenge. That there are more people without adequate sanitation than in China and India combined. Help us drive those numbers. Safe drinking water, an absolute essential element. The number three country, United States, Indonesia, Brazil, Russia, the next four countries in the world, combined populations. About what we're dealing with in terms of people who still don't have safe drinking water. The magnitude of this needs to be driven, and also the fact that it is within our grasp, because those Boy Scout troops, those Rotary clubs, those churches and synagogues, those volunteers, they understand how to do it. It's not expensive. It's not hard. We have it within our capacity to achieve this. I look forward to working with you and Senator Durbin in any way that I can. I do apologize, but actually, I'm not the chairman, but it is my hearing, so if I don't get there, I'm in trouble. So I need to step over and do that. But thank you for being here, and I look forward to celebrating World Water Week and the most successful session of Congress that we've ever enjoyed on this issue. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Durbin is on the way. He's been delayed just a tad. And so let me just say a few words of further introduction to this morning. We're very glad that you're here. We've been working on water for some time, but it is part of a larger program we've been trying to launch on what we call smart power. You know, I mean, it's for the last 10 years, really, we've been putting probably disproportionate emphasis on military power as a way to extend America's reach around the world. It's not unimportant. It's very important, obviously. And that's what I'm
from. I'm a defense guy, you know. But when you think about the Cold War, we prevailed in the Cold War not through military might. We needed to have enough military in order to prevent the political intimidation of Europe by the Soviet Union. But we didn't win the war through military might. We won it because of the power and dynamism of our economy and our society. The role of the military was to not have a war long enough so that these soft power attributes of America's power arsenal could really prevail. And that's really what made the difference. That's what's going to carry us through this era. You know, this is not a time when military muscle is going to convert hearts and minds. I saw what happened in Indonesia, where America's popularity before the tsunami was right around 20%. And after America walked in with real help, that genuine humanitarian impulse that runs through the American spirit, when that came in, America's popularity went up to 80%. This is not, you know, even a defense guy like me, we can get this. We understand how that works. So we need to start bringing the full spectrum of America's power resources to the table. And that is much, much more about our genuine disinterested humanitarianism, our commitment that every people, all people, ought to be living with, in this case, clean water, that we can, our future and our security, frankly, is improved when everybody's doing better. I mean, America is not going to be stronger and safer if the rest of the world is hungrier and poorer. It's never been our view. But we need to start looking at it in a much larger and integrated way. And Congressman Blumenauer pointed out the central role that clean water plays in the health and well-being of citizens around the world. You and I, did anybody here think this morning that water when you turn the tap was going to be safe? I didn't think about it. Just assumed it. How many people this morning, first of all, had to go walk several miles to get a little bit of water? You and I turned on a tap. So this is an opportunity, it's a great opportunity for America to rebuild in its full spectrum of its tools and resources and power base in the world if we were to become champions, real champions of, in this instance, one of the most fundamental of human needs. I'm very glad that this act was named after Paul Simon. I had the privilege of working here in the Senate at a time when Senator Simon was here. He embodied not only the progressive impulse that members of Congress had at that time, but such a deep commitment to decency. He never once came on the floor and said an angry or harsh word. I worked here for 9 years, you know, so we miss that. Thank you for being here today, Patty. Steve, can I ask you to come up and then introduce the rest of the program for today? And when Senator Durbin does come, and I know he is on the way, then we can I, if I could ask our panelists to come up here as well, because we don't want to hold the audience waiting for the Senator. And if, we'll just interrupt things when he does arrive. Steve, would you join me? Thank you again all for coming. We're delighted to have you here. Steve.
Sure, I think that's good. Yeah.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS. I direct the Global Health Policy Center there. We'll be having a roundtable in a moment with a couple of water experts, Winston Yu from the World Bank, Eric Peterson, who is a colleague at CSIS, and Jim Kunder. The senator is approaching, so I'm going to hold on that and allow him to come forward. And after the senator has spoken, I'd like to ask Patty Simon if she would care to offer some comments, and then we'll transition right away to the roundtable.
Ladies and gentlemen, obviously Senator Durbin doesn't need a lot of introduction, but as the majority whip, he's the busiest guy in the Senate. For him to take time out and join us on this issue speaks again to his commitment to this deep opportunity that we face as Americans to make a grand and important and self-interested gesture to improve the world. Senator Durbin.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it very much, and thank you all. Many of you are veterans of Capitol Hill and know the historic significance of this room, but those who aren't may be interested in taking a moment to read that notice on the back wall of all of the things that have occurred in this chamber, starting with the investigation of the sinking of the Titanic, going through Iran-Contra and Watergate, Clarence Thomas, so many hearings in this room. So it's truly an historic room, and I'm glad that you're here in the Capitol if you're a newcomer to this scene. I'm sorry I missed Earl Blumenauer. I know he has been a terrific, not only a terrific friend, but a real inspired leader when it comes to efforts to deal with bringing clean water and basic sanitation to the world. He was the House sponsor of the Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act, and it's an honor to be part of a new effort with him and Congressman Don Payne and others. As we prepare to mark World Water Day this week, I want to spend a moment telling you this morning about the global water challenge as I see it and what I think we can do about it. First, thanks to the Center for Strategic and International Studies for hosting this meeting. Under John Hanley's leadership, with Steve Morrison at the Global Health Policy Center and Eric Peterson at the Global Strategy Institute, CSIS is one of the first places serious-minded, I've come to this point in my life, serious-minded people turn to for dependable, thoughtful analysis and recommendations on tough foreign policy questions. I also want to acknowledge the many people who are here representing USAID, other parts of our government, and scores of NGOs, philanthropies, and private companies working to solve the global water crisis. Thanks for the life-saving work that you do. It seems fitting that we're talking about water on St. Patrick's Day. The lush green hills of Ireland are a stunning example of the benefits of plentiful rainfall. And my staff reminds me that Irish water is also responsible for another gift from heaven because it's an essential ingredient in Guinness. And water is, of course, essential to human life. It is also true that in the fight against global poverty, there's no better development investment that we can make than clean, safe water for the world. I owe my passion on this issue to my friend and mentor, the man whose seat I now occupy in the Senate, the late Senator Paul Simon. I'm glad that Patty is here and has continued his work as a champion on water in her own right. So when I say I'm a follower of the Gospel of St. Paul, Paul Simon is partly whom I'm talking about. He was a profoundly good and wise man, but he was also visionary. He saw connections that many people missed. He saw answers to problems before many people saw the problems. You may know that in 1998 he wrote a book entitled Tapped Out, The Coming World Crisis in Water and What We Can Do About It. It may not have been a New York Times bestseller, but those of us who read it were inspired. Paul, it turns out, would go anywhere, talk to anyone, try to get people and governments to take the global water crisis seriously. In the last year of his life, he traveled to Israel to moderate a panel between Israeli and Palestinian water commissioners. He said that he and most of the people in the audience were amazed that the two commissioners agreed on almost everything. But when he looked in the newspapers the next day, there was no mention of the meeting. Not a word. Paul said that was because nobody was shouting at each other. And that's part of the challenge. The global water crisis is a quiet killer. In the developing world, 5,000 children die every day from easily preventable water-related diseases, cholera, typhoid, malaria, diseases that have been all but eradicated in wealthier nations. Most die silently. Around the world today, nearly 1 billion people lack access to clean, safe water. More than 2 billion people lack access to basic sanitation. And most of these people live on less than $2 a day. They are the voiceless and powerless of the world. Water is not simply a humanitarian challenge. It's a threat to global stability and to the global economy. Last June, Goldman Sachs held a meeting to assess the top 5 risks facing the world economy. Resource scarcity, including competition for water, food, and energy, was at the top of the list. Fortune magazine recently predicted that the global water crisis will be as serious in the 21st century as the oil crises were in the 20th, potentially leading to war. Paul Simon understood the potential for conflicts over dwindling supplies of clean water. It alarmed him. He used to say, nations go to war for oil, but there are substitutes for oil. There are no substitutes for water. We see that in the roots of the conflict in Darfur. I saw it 2 years ago when I traveled to Jordan. I went there to talk about the impact of the war in Iraq. The Jordanian Minister of Planning, Ms. Suha Al-Ali, told me that between 600,000 and 700,000 Iraqis refugees were living in Jordan at the time. I said, what's the biggest problem here? Is it jobs? Is it school? She said, no, it's water. The refugees represented 10% of the population of Jordan. They were coming in and they needed water. For us in the United States, 10% of the population being refugees would be the equivalent of 30 million people arriving in our country. The massive influx of Iraq refugees had strained the ability of Jordan's government to provide basic services to the breaking point. But the big problem was water. And it's not just Jordan. Water is central to the fate of the entire Middle East. In his book, Paul Simon quoted former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who said, if we solve every other problem in the Middle East but do not satisfactorily resolve the water problem, our region will explode. Peace will not be possible. And you don't have to travel halfway around the world to hear this story. A few months ago, I traveled back to Haiti for a second time. A 90-minute plane ride from Miami takes you to an entirely different world. There are no public sewage treatment plants or disposal systems anywhere in Haiti. Even the capital, Port-au-Prince, a city of 2 million people, the drainage canals are choked with garbage and sewage. It is no wonder that Haiti has the highest infant and child mortality rate in the Western Hemisphere. One-third of Haiti's children do not live to see the age of 5. The leading killer? Waterborne disease. Hepatitis, typhoid, diarrhea. Some years ago, I visited Bolivia, one of the poorest countries in Latin America, second only to Haiti. Bolivia is an example of what awaits many countries' water supplies because of global warming. Much of the population relies on melting glaciers for water. But because of climate change, the glaciers are not being replenished. Some are disappearing. These trends are happening from the snows of Mount Kilimanjaro to the Alps to the Himalayas. How will the world respond to water needs such as Bolivia and others who rely on glaciers for their water supplies? Just a few weeks ago, I was on the island of Cyprus, divided now for more than 30 years. The Turkish Cypriots received their water in tankers from Turkey. The leaders on both sides are now engaged in a brave and important discussion to find peace and resolve their differences. At one point, though, they'll have to resolve the issue of water. Cyprus's groundwater is being depleted too quickly, often for agriculture in inefficient ways, and it's being replenished too often with salt water that creeps into the water table. Global warming is causing rainfall to decrease on that island. Paul Simon knew 10 years ago, and the rest of us are slowly coming to see, is that we can't resolve the problems of global hunger and poverty without addressing the global water crisis. Think about this. People need 50 liters of water per day to meet basic needs, 50 liters. According to Johns Hopkins, the average American uses 578 liters per day. In Africa, home to nearly 1 billion people, the average person uses 47 liters of water per day, 3 liters less than what we consider the basic requirement. The health consequences are profound. The World Health Organization estimates that at any given time, close to half the people in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world are suffering from diseases caused by unsafe water and poor sanitation. Children are the most vulnerable. Diarrhea alone kills nearly 2 million children under the age of 5 each year. A CSIS Global Water Futures report pointed out that's the equivalent of all the children under the age of 5 in New York and London combined. Mothers who fear the deaths of their children bear more children in a desperate race against the odds. And the lack of clean water enslaves poor women in many other ways. In the poorest nation, women and girls walk 2 or 3 hours or more each day, every day, to collect water that's often dirty and unsafe. The United Nations estimates that women and girls in sub-Saharan Africa spend a total of 40 billion working hours each year collecting water. 40 billion. That's the equivalent of all the hours worked in France in a given year. A developing economy can't grow if its people are too busy collecting water, are too sick from drinking water, to work or go to school. The UN recognized that fundamental reality when it included among its Millennium Development Goals cutting in half the proportion of people living without sustainable access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation by 2015. That may seem like an unrealistic goal to some, but our own history here in America shows that it's possible to make rapid progress to meet these most basic human needs. In American cities in the 19th century, waterborne disease accounted for 1 out of 10 deaths. Back then, the infant mortality rate right here in Washington, D.C., was twice the rate in sub-Saharan Africa today. In the mid-1880s, 12% of the entire population of Chicago, 12%, died of waterborne disease from drinking water from Lake Michigan. At the time, the lake was used for water and for waste. The Columbian Exhibition, also known as Chicago World's Fair in 1893, faced sure failure when the British medical journal Lancet warned visitors to that fair that a recent typhoid scourge was evidence that Chicago tap water was unsafe to drink. The fair developer, a legendary man, Daniel Bonham, turned to new water folders that had just been developed at that time by Louis Pasteur for the fair's drinking fountains, and, to be extra cautious, he set up a chemical laboratory on the grounds of the World's Fair to continually test the water every single day so he could give assurance to visitors that it was safe to drink. Some experts believe water purification alone explains half the reduction in mortality in the United States in the first 30 years of the 20th century. Some say the solution to today's water shortage is virtually unregulated privatization. If you read Sunday's New York Times, you may have a different view. They had a story about Chili's experiment with water rights as private property, not as a public resource. The story described a little town called Quiagua near Chile's northern Pacific coast. A private mining company owned 75% of the water rights in that town. Decades ago, before the water became a private commodity, the town supported farming and fishing. Now, Quiagua is a dying town. Most of its residents have moved, and the town's listed in record books as the driest place on earth. There's a better solution. 2 years after Paul Simon died, with the leadership of Earl Blumenau and others, we passed the Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act. President Bush signed it into law in December of 2005. It represents the first time the U.S. has codified our commitment to any of the Millennium Development Goals. That act makes safe water and basic sanitation a top priority for all U.S. foreign assistance. In 2007 alone, Water for the Poor Act helped provide nearly 2 million people in over 30 countries with access to better sources of drinking water and more than 1.5 million people with better sanitation. The Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act is saving lives, but its impact could be greater. Today, Senators Bob Corker and Patty Murray and I are introducing a new bill, the Paul Simon Water for the World Act. Our bill will reestablish U.S. leadership on water around the world. The goal is to reach an additional 100 million of the world's poorest people with sustainable access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation by 2015. This would represent the largest single commitment of any donor country to meeting the Millennium Development Goals on water. Let me just say as an aside here, I've spoken to the president, he was then the president-elect, about this, and some of the people near him. We both have a common political heritage and legacy in Paul Simon. And I said to President Obama, Paul Simon doesn't want a statue. He would never ask that a building be named after him. But if in his name we could do something like this to carry on this great idea and reach the poorest people in the world, it would be the greatest tribute possible to this man. And I added, we now have people around the world who are trying to define the United States. Greedy, selfish, self-centered. We can redefine our country to many new residents of the world if we are working on the basic needs that they face every single day. We can also start bringing together people from many different parts of the political spectrum who would war over many other things but understand they have a common challenge when it comes to water and sanitation. I think it's a great opportunity for our country to redefine ourselves for some and to define ourselves for many others. I'm hoping this administration sees it the same way. Now, the bill we introduced targets areas with the greatest need. It helps build the capacity of poor nations to meet their own water and sanitation needs. It provides technical assistance, best practices, credit authorities, and training to help countries expand access to clean water and sanitation. Our development experts will design the assistance based on local needs. Some solutions are very simple and cost very little. I'll give you an example. The U.S. Center for Disease Control has developed a simple chlorine solution, similar to household bleach, which would allow a family of six to disinfect its drinking water at the cost of less than one penny a day. I saw a similar life-saving water treatment just a few weeks ago when I went to Cange in Haiti and visited the rural health clinic there, run by a group called Partners in Health. Many of you probably know one of the founders, Dr. Paul Farmer. He's a great guy who's improved the lives of so many from Haiti to Rwanda and other places in the world. Dr. Farmer showed me a water purification kit that his clinic gave to nursing mothers with HIV/AIDS. It allows them to make formula for their babies and not transmit the virus through breastfeeding. It is simple, inexpensive, and life-saving. This week, 20,000 water and sanitation experts from around the world are meeting in Istanbul for the 5th World Water Forum. When I visited Ankara just a few weeks ago, they asked me to come to it, but I had to explain to them when you have 59 votes in the Senate, you can't take a week off. So I was unable to be there, but I'm glad that so many people from around the world will be there. Cross-border partnerships can yield important scientific and technological breakthroughs. It can help diffuse conflicts over water shortages, and it can help to create the political will to tackle this problem. Finally, our bill designates within the State Department a high-level representative to ensure that water receives priority attention in foreign policy, establishes a new office of water at USAID to implement development assistance efforts related to water. We ought to be assigning some of our best minds to solve the global water challenge. Right now, however, we don't have the staff at USAID to meet our goals on water or any other urgent development need. If you take a look at the numbers of people working at USAID, they have unfortunately declined dramatically as our needs around the world have grown dramatically. To correct this imbalance and help rebuild our smart power, I recently introduced a bill that would triple the number of USAID workers. We ought to be assigning some of our best minds to solve the global water challenge. Right now, however, we don't have the staff to do it. I believe that this bill has a good chance to triple the number of USAID Foreign Service Officers by 2012. It's called Increasing America's Development Capacity Act. President Obama is deeply committed to reducing global poverty, including water poverty, not just because it's right, but because it's in America's national interest. He's assembled a team of leaders who share his commitment. Secretary of State Clinton, Defense Secretary Gates have both pointed out that development assistance, our generosity and ability to help those in need overseas, must be a critical part of our foreign policy efforts. By bringing safe water and basic sanitation to 100 million of the world's poorest people, the Paul Simon Water for the World Act will make America safer by reaffirming our standing as a leader in the fight to end global poverty. It will help prevent humanitarian catastrophes and dangerous conflicts around the world. Now, some are going to say, this is not the time, Durbin. We've got a poor economy here, you know, and we've got to be thoughtful about America first and the needs of our people. I don't disagree with that. But recovering from this recession and rebuilding our economy for the long term must be our government's top priority, but not our only priority. The Paul Simon Water for the World Act is a smart strategy that will make our foreign assistance dollars go a lot further and achieve a lot more, which is what we need in these hard economic times. According to the UN Development Program, every dollar invested in water and sanitation yields an average economic return of $8. In fact, the UN Development Program estimates that meeting the Millennium Development Goal on water will place us roughly 30% of the way toward achieving every other Millennium Development Goal. In closing, appropriately, the Irish had a saying, you never miss the water till the well has run dry. In too many parts of the world today, the wells are running dry, or they haven't been dug yet. As we prepare to mark World Water Day this Sunday, let's recommit ourselves to a new effort on safe water and sanitation. Throughout history, civilized nations have put aside political differences to address compelling issues of life and survival. Our generation owes the world nothing less. Working together, we can make a real difference in the lives of the world's poor. Thank you for inviting me to join you today. I appreciate it very much.
care to come and say a few words?
Paul Simon was my husband. And for any of you who ever worked with Paul know, he liked to give assignments. And I guess water was the assignment he left for me, because I spent a lot of time traveling with him around the world looking at water projects and water needs. As a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Paul became acutely aware of a coming worldwide water crisis. Whether it was standing on a wharf at the edge of what had been of the oil sea and looking out on a dry lake bed, or watching the effects of waterborne diseases and people dying of thirst in Somalia because of a lack of water, Paul knew that it was going to take a great deal of leadership and commitment to reach out and conquer some of these problems, and as many as possible. It's going to take a great deal of work around the world to reach all of the needs that are there. But we have seen leadership in the efforts of Earl Blumenauer and his sponsors to do this with the Water for the Poor Act. And today we see another act of leadership from Senator Durbin in the introduction of the Water for the World Act. Paul would be so pleased to see the United States reaching out to the rest of the world and taking a leadership role in meeting these needs. But it's also going to take the commitment of everyone here today and everyone we can recruit to reach these goals. I thank you for all that you do to make this a better world. And I look forward to working with any of you that I have the opportunity to reach the goals of making this a better world in the area of water. Thank you so much for all you do.
Thank you, Mrs. Simon. Thank you, Senator Durbin and Congressman Blumenauer. I want to offer special thanks to Sarah Hand from Senator Durbin's staff and Karen Meacham from CSIS for pulling us all together here. We're going to transition right now into a roundtable conversation for the next 45 minutes in which we will be engaging you in that roundtable discussion. I'd like to invite Winston, you, Jim Kunder, and Eric Peterson to come up and join me here. I'll say a few opening remarks, and then we'll start off with a couple of key questions that follow on to the legislation that has been presented here this morning. So give me just 15 seconds to move this and we'll get started. Thank you. Welcome. I will introduce our other speakers and then provide some opening remarks. To my left is Jim Kunder, familiar to many of you. He served in many key positions at USAID during the Bush administration and during the previous Bush administration of President Herbert Walker Bush. His most recent role was as the deputy administrator of USAID for several years in this last administration. And prior to that, as the assistant administrator and deputy assistant administrator in the Asian Near East Bureau and a lead role in the Afghanistan reconstruction work. Very demanding, critical work that he was involved with. Previous to that, he was the director of the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, and I had the pleasure of working with him early part of the Clinton administration, putting together the Office of Transition Initiatives, an initiative working in places emerging out of conflict where these issues around reconstruction and water and social services was front and center. Thank you, Jim, for joining us. Winston Yu has joined us from the World Bank. He's a water resources specialist at the World Bank, working in the South Asia region. He came out of a program at Harvard, the water program, which was a multidisciplinary program grounded principally in the engineering sector, but reaching into political science, sociology, economics, organizational theory. He completed his PhD in that program, and so he's one of very few American true water, professionally trained water specialists. making a career in this domain, and we're thrilled that Winston can join us here today, and we're thrilled that we have the World Bank represented, because I think in the course of our discussion it will become clear just how important the multilaterals and especially the World Bank are in this. He's also, I have to say, a classical violinist the last 30 years and a former member of the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra. We're not going to ask you to perform this morning. Eric Peterson is a colleague, a longstanding colleague at CSIS. He runs the Global Strategy Institute. Prior to that, for many years, was a director of studies at CSIS. He's led many broad initiatives like the Water Initiative. He will say a few words, I expect, about the rollout tomorrow of a major statement of principles, a declaration on U.S. policy and global challenges of water, which is very, very complementary and tracks very closely in spirit and logic to the legislation that we've heard about this morning. That effort has been pioneered by Eric and co-chaired by Senator William Frist, a CSIS trustee, former majority leader here in the Senate, and Neville Isdale, chairman of the Coca-Cola Corporation and also a CSIS trustee. So welcome, Eric. Just a few words before we launch into this conversation. We're in the midst of this dialogue around what do we do with respect to water and sanitation as part of our overall foreign assistance strategies. It's occurring in the middle of two historic transitions that further complicate matters, and we'll talk a little bit about that. One is, obviously, we're at the beginning of the Obama administration. This is a president who, in his inaugural address, said, "To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds." That was a beautiful and eloquent statement, and I think it was one that registered quite powerfully around the world and certainly received a lot of attention here in this country, particularly among those of you who work these issues and have the expertise and know what it means to have a statement of that unequivocal power in the center of President Obama's inaugural address. We are now in the midst of a debate around where the foreign assistance strategy is to move, and it's an unresolved debate. It's an active one. It's one that is unfolding in the course of the next year or beyond. It's one that has to do with how we mesh the inheritance, the historic achievements of our global health investments with pressing other developmental priorities and prerogatives, among them sanitation and water, re-engaging in agriculture and productivity and the like. And I think that having these discussions here today is part of that broader span of debate and dialogue here. We're really in a process of sort of revisiting many of the fundamental issues, and that's very promising. Obviously, also, we're in the midst of a worsening global economic crisis, and this is one which creates it tilts the situation. It puts a different cast on it. It creates scarcities and tensions and distractions that make it, in some respects, more difficult, but in other respects, it is going to create opportunity and openings in which these kinds of issues may surface as having greater traction and potential as we move forward. The U.S. Why this bill, why this legislation, why this charter that Eric has put together, part of it is the shift of consciousness to the centrality around health, around sanitation, around water, and also an awareness that the U.S. is in fact ill-equipped institutionally and programmatically and fiscally to really take this issue on. It's not always been the case. In the 50s and 60s, it was water and sanitation were priorities. There was much greater expertise and institutional capacities and an ability to move forward within our own borders on water issues as well as overseas. But for a variety of reasons, those capacities began to diminish. And right now, what we're talking about is attempting to reconstitute them. The resources that we commit, the $700 million a year that is committed bilaterally outside of our borders, it's very concentrated in settings like Iraq, where the urgent requirements in the midst of sort of reconstitution in a war setting Much of the other assistance that we commit is scattered across a multitude of agencies and tends to be sort of derivative or secondary to, through some other purpose. And the central authority and coordination and vision around how the what the objectives are and how we go about achieving them is not there. And this is what I think what we're talking about today in terms of the Senator Durbin's legislation, the work that Eric has carried forward, and elsewhere. I think also we have to admit that water is inherently a very difficult issue. It's one that carries with it such multiple systems of engineering, of bureaucracies, of political power, of culture. It's something that requires such a mobilization of effort that it has to be done with special care and special expertise. And I think also we have to admit as part of this that the multilateral approach is going to be essential to success. And we are in a period in which this administration and Congress have recommitted to a renewed multilateral strategy and a search for such a thing. And in that regard, I think water and sanitation should be at the top of the list of opportunities for working much more collaboratively as we set forward. I want to open the discussion around one broad question, which is we're heading towards the G20. We're in the midst of a worsening economic crisis. There's an immediate struggle around how to restore demand in the global economy and how to bring about financial regulatory systems. But there's another debate that's out there that's being led by many other people, Robert Zoellick among them, Josette Sheeran at the World Food Program and others, saying there's an agenda around the poorest of the poor, around the implications of this global economic crisis on health, on access to water, on access to sanitation, and the like. Perhaps we could open by just asking our three panelists to comment, how is this issue going to play, this issue around re-engaging at a multilateral and a bilateral level on water and sanitation, how is it going to play in this current context of a worsening global economic crisis, greater fear and insecurity, and several key inflection points that lie ahead, the G20, the G8, the UN Heads of State Summit in September, the Istanbul Water Summit that is occurring just in the course of this week. Eric, would you care to just open up, and then I'll ask Winston and Jim. I want to have a sort of rapid roundtable on this opening question. Thank you.
Delighted to do that. Thank you, Steve. In my view, there can be little doubt that the broader multinational agenda now will be squeezed by the triage agenda brought about by the current and wide economic and financial dislocation that we see across the world. That clearly will be the central priority, as Senator Durbin, among others, have suggested here this morning. But in the end, there has to be an agenda beyond the short term and the immediate. And I think that the issue that the senator mentioned by highlighting the Goldman Sachs report about future resource dislocations is likely to come up time and time again in these fora, Steve, that you mentioned coming up, leading up, by the way, to the Copenhagen event on global warming at the end of the year. In my view, we got a taste of what will come yet again when we see a recovery of the economy. Last spring, when we saw food dislocation in a number of areas across the world, significant water pressures that we're all here to think about, and beyond that, the volatility in energy markets has certainly been on display. All that is likely to resurrect itself, and I think that we're all on countdown in one way or another to try to figure out the tremendously complex linkages that exist across these resource areas as we move from a triage on current financial situation into a broader resource agenda.
Okay. As we all know, the challenges to reaching the poor and providing access to clean water are enormous, and it requires the involvement of many different groups of people, not just the public sector, but also the private sector, NGO communities, and so forth and so forth. So I think it's clear that, as Eric has already mentioned, that this current financial crisis will have a huge impact on countries' abilities to provide services, and certainly this crisis will only make that challenge even greater. With that in mind, when we think about all the different sources of financing that are available to meet these demands, you know, we know that the investment gap is huge. Okay, we know that the resources that it will take are enormous. To the extent that we can increase ODA, to the extent that we can reduce the risks for the private sector, to the extent that we can provide more grant financing, to the extent that we can get NGOs and other communities of practice involved, I think that is certainly one way forward.
Thank you. Jim?
Steve, if you will just indulge me for 1 second, I just wanted to say what an honor it was to be here with Mrs. Simon. This will seem astonishing to those under 40 in the audience, but I was young once, and I was a junior staffer in the early 1970s on Capitol Hill working for a junior congressman from Pennsylvania, and we were on the 7th floor of the Longworth building where they put junior congressmen from Pennsylvania, and right next to us was a junior congressman from Illinois by the name of Paul Simon, and so I had a chance to observe the senator up close and personal for a couple of years, and all of us grapple in Washington with how we're going to balance being good people with being effective in Washington. If there was ever a living, walking, breathing embodiment of somebody who was able to do good and still be an effective legislator, it was Paul Simon. So it's really an honor to be here today and meet you. I think it's interesting, if you haven't looked at the agenda for the World Water Forum in Istanbul that's been referenced a couple of times, I would recommend you go and take a look at it, since none of us obviously had the opportunity to attend. And Steve, to answer your question directly, I think it's critical that when you look at that agenda, you see issues that relate water to energy and energy to water. You look at issues that relate water to finance. And so, to me, the issues of water availability, water supply, not only have dramatic impacts in terms of the livelihoods of the poor, and not only have dramatic impacts in looking at issues of riparian rights, conflict related to water, and so forth, but water is intrinsic to economic development, to economic activity writ large. And it seems to me that as we grapple with the availability of financing for economic recovery, you immediately get into the intersection of water needs and economic recovery. So I think that the two are intrinsically interrelated. I think many of you know that in response to the requirement in the Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act, the state and USAID submit an annual report to Congress, and embedded in that report is a strategic framework. If you haven't taken a look at that, you also ought to take a look at that, because aid needs your, USAID needs your comments on whether we're doing the right things. But throughout that, you see the interrelationship of economic activity and water, and maybe we'll come back to this later, but very specifically, one of the areas where there's been some real progress made is in the public-private partnerships with corporations like Coca-Cola and the U.S. government to try to drive economic activity and water issues together.
Thank you. It does seem, when you look at the success that's been achieved in the last few years around the global HIV/AIDS programs, the malaria initiative, more recently on tuberculosis, these were areas that had a couple of conspicuous features. They had White House leadership. They had a clear and looming threat, that, particularly on the HIV/AIDS. They had finite interventions and results that could be tied to those. When you talk about water and sanitation, what you're talking about is a much quieter burden of suffering and disease when populations that do not enjoy good sanitation or potable water. When you have diarrheal diseases, you have high mother and child morbidity and mortality, and some of the figures are quite alarming, but it's a quieter drama. It's one also that is not as much of a conspicuous threat over the in the immediate sense to stability and to U.S. interests, and it's also something that is a little more difficult to capture programmatically. And it seems to me that creating a central locus within the bureaucracy, creating a leadership coordinator, getting focus countries with a strategies for each focus countries, that's a long step forward, several big steps forward at overcoming the endemic problems of conveying to an American public and to policymakers why this is so important, why it's worth investing more, and what can you do to sort of see results. And those components, it would seem to me, are important. And it dates back to this 2005 original piece of legislation that sort of set us off on that particular track. Let me ask our speakers here, if there were two or three critical things that U.S. government should do or World Bank should do in the next 2 years on water and sanitation to move the dial, what would those be? Jim, why don't we go with you and move this direction? But, you know, what are the two or three things that are the sine qua non that will have some catalytic impact in moving the dial on water and sanitation? And we should keep those in our minds.
First of all, Steve, I completely agree with what you just said. I think the idea of creating the office within AID under the Act makes a lot of sense, because there are a lot of aspects to water issues, as I was trying to describe earlier, and I think having that focal office will really make sure that whenever, you know, as we all deal in large bureaucracies, whenever a discussion comes up where there's some water-related issues, somebody's going to make sure that we're taking a look at the water-related issues. This is going to sound awfully boring, I think, but I'm just struck by the fact that even the amounts of money that Senator Durbin was talking about are as large as they are. Make a relatively modest impact. And even if I look at all the multilateral and bilateral donor flows around the world that are going into water, it seems to me, to answer your question, catalytic, we've got to look at the issues of leveraging financing. And I would argue not just leveraging financing, but creating the mechanisms to generate financing. We had some rich discussions between USAID and the French Development Agency, which is tending to focus not just on national ministerial level interventions, but at the level of authorities. If you look at how water or sanitation is financed in the United States, it's through water authorities and sanitation authorities, which then have developed the skill sets and the capacity to leverage private sector financing, which, by the way, has important, I think, participatory and democratic effects as well. I guess I'm not going to miss the opportunity to put in a plug for more staffing at USAID, but my heart leapt for joy when Senator Durbin was speaking, because, you know, when we're talking about figuring out better capacity in the developing world, building capacity in the developing world, building finance, access to finance. I mean, these things just don't happen by dumping a few more dollars into a country. You've got to have staff on the ground who are building partnerships with the private sector, with the university sector, with the community organization sector. And so I think we've got to recognize that if we're really going to sustain this water effort, we're going to have to invest in getting more state and USAID folks on the ground to make this kind of thing happen.
Thank you. Winston.
Okay, yeah. To build on that, because there's such a huge investment gap, of course, you know, we need to use these resources as wisely as possible. So you asked for two or three items. Let me give you four. I call them the four I's: investments, institutions, information, and incentives. Clearly, for urban municipal systems, for example, these investments are enormous, they're capital intensive, they're lumpy. So how do we bring in resources to satisfy those needs? Or if we're looking at rural systems, for instance, these tend to be very distributed, and so you've got an issue of size and scale. But clearly, without these investments, progress will not be possible, right? So we start with investments. On the other hand, we need proper institutions. And when I say institutions, I mean it broadly speaking to include the regulatory reform policy, the different regulatory frameworks that you have, because without these institutions in place, your investments will be unsustainable. And we see this time and time after again that this water crisis is not necessarily a crisis about lack of supply, but perhaps it's actually a crisis of governance and how we manage this resource. Thirdly, on this issue of information, you know, to make any sound decision about how you use water in your country, you need to have good information. And from what I've seen in the developing world in South Asia and Africa, you do not have access to information. We here in the United States are fortunate because we have the USGS, the National Weather Service, NOAA, NASA, so forth, monitoring our country, monitoring where flows are going, how much rain we're going to get, so forth and so forth. In many countries, we don't see this. So unfortunately, information is a prerequisite. And lastly, incentives. Water is political. We all know that. In fact, if you look at the Chinese character for the word politics, it's actually two roots, a root for water and a root for harmony. And the fact these two radicals come together to produce a word that means political, I think, is a little bit interesting. And because water is political and because it's deep into social systems, proper incentives, proper pricing, clear roles, responsibilities, and accountability are extremely important. So those are four things: investments, information, incentives, and institutions.
Thank you, Eric.
Steve, let me offer three ideas here. The first is that how can we begin to deal with a critical global resource like water without having a better appreciation of what it's worth? How can we establish a value for water? For those of you with water in front of you in a plastic bottle, what is that water worth? I mean, in the end, there are fundamental question marks about the value of water, and how can leaders across the world, if they are to discharge the governance responsibilities that Winston just mentioned, how can they begin to inform their decision-making in the absence of a clear understanding of the value of water? And I would argue that there are a number of skewed decisions on display in this country and elsewhere with respect to supply-demand issues involving water. The second point comes back to what I tried to suggest earlier. I believe that we need a much sharper understanding of these complex linkages between food, water, and energy. And if I had a wish list, I guess what I do, Steve, is put together the respective modeling communities in such a way that we could begin to look at relentless population growth pressures, a range of other factors, all of which suggest bounds, decision-making bounds, for how we deal with water in key basins across the world. And we can't do it on a piece-by-piece basis. It has to be more nearly integrated by basin or area or whatever. And finally, a third suggestion. We have to commend our colleagues, 20,000 or so of whom who are convening now in Istanbul to talk about these issues. But in the end, is having a big conference like this every 3 years enough, a World Water Forum? Well, it's certainly a massive contribution to our thinking. But nevertheless, I would argue that perhaps we should think in terms of a broader international organizational approach that would allow us on a full-time, 24/7 basis to begin to continue exchanging ideas in all these critical areas.
Thank you. I'm going to offer a few of my own thoughts, and then we're going to open it to you for your comments and questions, and we'll be asking you to put your hand up and bring a microphone to you. I believe that's the arrangement we're going to pursue. The comment I wanted to make is it seems to me that since we're in this unprecedented crisis context of a worsening global economic crisis with great uncertainty around the direction it is going to move, that how we frame the discussion around water and sanitation becomes terribly important in the next 2 years and perhaps beyond. That it needs to be, it seems to me, tied to the concept of a safety net. We know from the last major recession, 78 to 82, that the education, health, and basic institutional budget support in the poorest of the poor countries was gutted.
and it took 15 years to recover. And we know that that's a very, very real probability today of regression. And I believe, I agree entirely with what Winston said, which is we have to come into this with our eyes open about the lack of capacity, current capacity, in those partner governments where we're really talking about trying to take this on. We have weaknesses in our own government within USAID in terms of releasing our and allowing for the diminution of our talent with respect to water, but we're also operating with partner governments that are under severe stress, that have limited capacities, and that's going to get worse. I think there's a stability agenda that's going to be upon us. We know already that the worsening global economic situation is engendering accelerating malnutrition and poverty and instability, and that it's likely to be worse. And I think Robert Zoellick's been most eloquent and powerful in enumerating the different vectors that are at play and the evidence that the bank is tracking of exactly how this is manifesting itself. These investments in sanitation and water are a path towards ensuring the viability of communities in this period, ensuring a statement of good faith contribution. They are a form of stimulus and stabilization is worthy and should be seen and acted upon, and it seems to me, and we haven't reached that point in the preparations for the G8 or the G20 or the other key inflection points. And you, Eric, you mentioned the climate change agenda, which is another very huge proportion of this. This is an administration that cares passionately. This is a time period in which, as we move towards Copenhagen, there is the possibility of a very renewed effort around this. In the midst of this, despite this crisis, these issues have to be at the center of that. So thank you for indulging me. I would like to take a round of questions and comments from three or four folks. We're going to move this.
Why don't I just invite you to come forward and speak to this? I apologize, but why don't you come up, ma'am?
Thank you. My name is Alan Hoffman. I'm at the U.S. Department of Energy. And without taking anything away from the urgency of the international situation, which is overwhelming, 80% of the infections in the developing world are waterborne diseases. We have to address that. But I want to focus it a little bit more on the U.S., where we have our own water problems. And I'm very pleased to see people talking about the connection between water and energy, because you cannot separate the two issues. They're linked at the hip. I want to ask you a question about a step we could take in this country. Given the fact that energy has historically been a federal issue and water has been typically a state or a local issue, is it time for us to establish a National Water Commission to really bring together decision makers in both areas of water and energy and perhaps other subjects so that we can address this as a national issue instead of sort of the scattered approach that we're taking today?
We're moving this over?
Yeah.
Thank you. We'll take three comments and then come back to our panelists. Please introduce yourself and then...
I'm Lexi Wertheim. I've been running an energy seminar series to educate not only the government but industry and anybody who wants to learn about energy and all the piece parts that belong to it. I consider all of this a humongous systems problem, and we don't educate Americans to think in terms of systems. We basically get educated to answer the question, not to ask them. And when a question is asked, we tend to come up with a one-off solution without thinking about the second, third, fourth order consequences. So I think we have a real educational problem ahead of us. And along those lines, my question is, how are we going to educate the American public on these very complicated issues? There was a wonderful video, 4-minute video, that was shown at Davos on water with no words. And you can find it on the internet. It was done by, I think, the Pacific Institute. But to let people understand the interrelation and the complexity, I think is incredibly important. So unless you start building these, and you talk about framing how you frame those stories so John Q. Public can understand it. I don't see how you're going to get the voters here to start wanting to put money into it because they don't understand it. I mean, I just spent the weekend with a fellow who was telling me why he didn't see why the rich should have to give up any money in this country to help pay for health care for anybody else. So we have an enormous education mindset issue. And it's not that it isn't a huge technical problem, but I think all these issues that we're facing are about people, how they think, feel, and behave. And that's changing behavior is lots harder than changing technology.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm Peter Kim, and I'm the chairman of the International Housing Coalition. We're an advocacy organization, and our principal interests are the billion people who live in slums around the world. Before getting involved in what I'm doing now, I was with AID for a very long time, including a fair number of years that Jim Kunder was there. So I'd say that one point I want to make is that a major hunk of the water problem, water for the poor, I would guess 30-40% of it, is the poor people who live in slums. And the issue of getting housing to them and the institutional incentive investment issues associated with that are a special subset of this problem, and one in which in recent years aid has become weaker and weaker. In addition to its need to set up a water office, it has to include within the water program the capacity to deal with the urbanization and the slums, which many people believe is the defining issue of the 21st century. The World Bank report recently, an in-house study called it that way, urbanization as the defining issue of the 21st century.
Thank you. We'll take one more comment and question, and then we'll come back to our panelists.
Yes. Right, and this is an elaboration.
Please identify yourself.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I'm David Conrad with National Wildlife Federation, a senior water resources specialist there here in Washington. This is just a little bit of an elaboration, I think, on Alan Huffman's question, and that is, it's been 40 years since the U.S. had a National Water Commission. Essentially, they did their publishing in 1972. We also, in the interim, have had, and then do not have, a cabinet-level council that had ongoing responsibility to review these issues called the U.S. Water Resources Council. My question, in addition to the question about a National Water Commission, is what do you think about the possibility of reestablishing that cabinet-level council that can help advise all levels of the government on these issues?
Thanks. Great. Thank you very much. Eric, do you want to lead off?
Sure. Sure. Happy to do that. We've devoted the lion's share of our attention to international water issues, but with respect to the two comments that focused on the U.S. water framework, I have a couple ideas to add. The first is that we need to begin here by acknowledging that we're racing into the future from behind the starting line. Many of you saw the latest report card of the American Society of Civil Engineers. The bottom line there is that when broader physical infrastructure is taken into account, this country scores at best a couple C's and a lot of D's. The Society, in a report that came out about 6 weeks ago, as I recall, estimated that we need an investment of $2.2 trillion in the next 5 years only to bring U.S. infrastructure up to a good level. A key component of that, clearly, is the water infrastructure. And I think we all need to be thinking in terms of what we can do, not only to modernize what we have, but to expand for future population expansions. With respect to the idea of a centralization of decision-making, I think what applies internationally could apply domestically. Very difficult to break down all the jurisdictions and competencies that exist right now, but I think that there's a very compelling case to be made.
Winston, take off your World Bank hat and speak as an American citizen.
Okay, as an American citizen. Actually, first, on the question of the National Water Commission, I think, Alan, that's a very intriguing idea. If you look globally at other countries, there are very few examples where you have real functioning national water commissions. Mexico, for instance, Conagua is sort of one of the examples everyone cites. And there's, whether or not that is achieving its objectives that it set out initially, I think, remains still to be seen. Integration is extremely important. As you mentioned, engineers need to work with economists, who need to work with public health specialists, who need to work with sociologists, so forth and so forth and so forth. And our current education system doesn't allow that. I'm an adjunct professor at SAIS, and I'm trying, for instance, to build bridges to the School of Public Health and the School of Engineering. But how can we do that when our budget cycles are different, our academic calendars are different, so students can't even, if they're in size, can't take a class over the School of Public Health. So that's an enormous, enormous challenge. And I think, if I were to change one thing, I think we have quite a bit of re-education that we need to do in terms of training tomorrow's water professionals. There was a question, I just want to quickly say something about the urbanization issue. We have to keep in mind that this is not necessarily a new challenge. When I think about ancient civilizations, the Romans, the Greeks, the Assyrians, all of the societies that grew up around the Nile Delta, the Tigris, Euphrates, water was central to survival of these cities, in fact, government bureaucracies evolved out of this control, this desire to control water. So in some respects, these are old challenges, but there is some silver lining. I think, technology and science and technology play an enormous role in improving our methods of providing services to people. So, urban cities are extremely important, and, as we know in the developing world, urbanization rates are enormous, so big, big issue.
Thank you, Winston. Jim?
Just in general, on this question of, national water commission, cabinet level councils and so forth, to generalize that a bit, I think to relate it to Peter Kim's comments about what do you do in sprawling urban slums in the developing world, this is one of the fundamental critical questions. Are we looking at some kind of top-down, bottom-up approach? Are we looking at massive investment so that we can put public systems in to serve people? Are we looking at micro-technologies of the kind that I think Senator Durbin referred to earlier, the penny-per-family investment in Haiti? These are fundamental questions, and they all come to a head in the kind of situations where Peter Kim were talking about, where you got people jammed together and simply don't have access to water and sanitation. But I'd like to just comment on this question of public education. I think it's particularly sad that I think you asked the question about shouldn't we be doing better at educating the public the day that the Seattle Post-Intelligencer puts its last issue out today. This is a fundamental problem. I'm old enough, I keep focusing on my age here, I'm old enough to remember when we took civics classes in school, and I've never understood why we thought we could run a functioning democratic society without investing a little bit of money in public education, in grappling with how investments are financed, or what is an authority, what is a water authority. This stuff just doesn't intrinsically get into the minds of our children. So I guess I'm, as Steve intimated, I'm a Republican. Sort of national commissions don't automatically strike me as the best response. But certainly the public has got to understand how all of this stuff knits together in order to make informed public choices. So I think this is something that you need to hit at the basic public education level if you're going to have informed decision-making, either in the United States or in the developing world.
I just want to add to Mitzi's question and Jim's comment that, we have to be very, very realistic and hard-headed at this moment, because the opinion data, the survey data that's coming forward of American opinion trends, and there's multitude of the most competent and active surveyors are extremely active right now out there tracking the opinion, and it's not a very pretty picture with respect to foreign assistance. And it's not even pretty when you're talking about those forms of foreign assistance that scored big wins in the last decade and drew strong bipartisan support, and it showed dramatic concrete results. Even there, there's the fear factor, the insecurity, and the
uncertainty is eating away at a certain measure of people's confidence in this. The counter to that is, you know, we now have a budget that's for this next phase, it looks pretty good in terms of preserving commitments and preserving gains. But on the opinion side, I think we're going to have to work doubly hard in order to make the case to use the arrival of this legislation, building on the earlier act, the sort of work that Eric's carrying forward, the sort of work that Zelik is carrying forward in the bank, to sort of bring all of that across. We have time for another round of comments and questions, and then we'll... So I would like to invite another group. Just be cautious around this microphone. Don't trip over the wire. Please just identify yourself. I'd like to invite any other folks who would like to offer comments or questions.
Good morning. Great session so far. My name is Hillary Critchley. I'm with Vestergaard Franzen, a Swiss company that innovates products for public health programs, mainly for developing countries. Our water purification tool is named LifeStraw. There's a personal and family-based unit. And actually, Winston, a lot of what you have been saying has really rung true in terms of the challenges that we face in terms of innovation and scaling up. And one of the things you mentioned was regulatory reforms and frameworks, and something that's kind of lacking, I believe, in the water sector is guidelines in terms of what water quality standards does a product or intervention need to have. Is U.S. funding, should that go to, you know, U.S. EPA standard requirements, or is there any kind of guidance that we should start to think about providing both private and public sector organizations? Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Dick Engberg. I'm technical director of the American Water Resources Association. I want to comment that I think we certainly need to work on world water issues, but as a couple of other speakers have already mentioned, national issues are important as well. And I think part of the reason why we need to work on national issues is our overall water policy. I'd say that at best, our overall water policy at this point is ad hoc. And the reason I say that is that if you look at the laws and regulations that have been passed to govern national water policy and look at the laws that were passed prior to 1950, they would all be related to development issues. And you look at the laws pretty much passed since 1950, they would be related to environmental concerns. So, And since these are all on the books, you have agencies that are working on the one side on development issues, you have organizations that are on the other side on environmental issues, and there are conflicts and contradictions between these sets of laws. So I think that one thing we need is a cogent water policy as we move into the 21st century to not only address our own issues, but the issues on the world stage as well. And I guess I would say that as a result of these two sets of laws out there are addressing these things primarily both nationally and internationally, we tend to address these more reactively than proactively. And I think that the proactive addressing of these problems is what we need in the 21st century, and I think the legislation that Senator Durbin and others have introduced will go a long ways to doing this. But I also think that possibly the idea of reinstituting a National Water Commission certainly is something that needs to be done. I realize this is not a question, it's only a comment, but I think there's some need to it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Jenny Montgomery. I'm a AAAS fellow at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And I guess I did have a question. One of the panelists mentioned that we do a pretty good job in this country of monitoring our water resources. And I guess I would say that's certainly true in terms of meteorology, probably less so in terms of flow and groundwater storage and even our water quality monitoring system. And my question is, for this new legislation that's being proposed, what are your thoughts as to how much of it's going to actually devoted towards increasing monitoring and the
gathering of water information in these countries as opposed to just dealing with treatment interventions, which is a little bit, probably a little easier to tackle than setting up institutions for monitoring.
On that last question, it might be worthwhile inviting one of the staff members involved in this, Sarah, or if you care to offer any comment, because it's really directed at the legislation.
Sarah Handy with Senator Durbin's office. There is a part of the bill that deals with monitoring and evaluation, mostly to do with the programs and the sort of strategies to expand access to water and sanitation. So in terms of water quality and so forth, that's probably not a direct component of the bill, but it would be built in, we hope, to the broader kind of monitoring framework. Does that help?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you very much. So we have a couple of different questions. Hillary's question around standards with respect to water purification, that touches into the whole global food safety issue potentially, and the fact that we've got a renewed focus on the FDA and Peggy Hamburg and this whole question of does this play in that domain. Dick Enberg's question the overall water policy as a domestic piece, and then Jenny's question, which we've just heard in response. Let me just invite our speakers to offer some sort of closing remarks on those two and anything else you want to add, and then we'll wrap it up. Eric, you want to lead off? We'll go Eric Winston.
All right. Let me kick off here by hedging on the question of water quality, because we haven't done any direct work in that area. There are others much better prepared to address that question than I. But I would like to leave you with a couple thoughts. The first is that as we think about framing this issue, as Steve mentioned, in the context of the current political and economic and financial dynamics, I think all of us here need to take to heart the view that this is not only human health, as critical as that is, as the Senator laid out. It's not only environmental stewardship. It's not only dealing with population growth and a range of other factors, but it has serious implications long range for stability and security. So we need to think about this across the spectrum of U.S. interests. And in my view, this kind of approach gives us the opportunity to do well when it comes to serving U.S. interests by doing good, by dealing with broader millennium development challenges and a range of other factors. This is an amazing confluence now that we need to exploit, in my view, if we hope to turn around where things are. The second point, and I apologize, this falls into the shameful plug category. But tomorrow at CSIS, we are rolling out a water declaration, as Steve mentioned, very close to the spirit of the legislation that you heard about earlier from Senator Durbin, that will be co-chaired by two of our trustees at CSIS, Neville Isdell, the chairman of Coca-Cola on the one hand, and Bill Frist, the former Senate Majority Leader, who was involved in the Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act sponsorship originally during his term. There are a number of signatories to that declaration that represent as wide a spectrum as what I just suggested, political, special level of expertise, etc. And I hope that you'll tune in. We're having an event at CSIS tomorrow morning. More will be posted on the website, but now is a chance for us all to be thinking very seriously about where we're taking this whole challenge of water.
Okay. Very quickly, on the issue of standards, I mean, there are international standards in terms of water quality. I mean, the challenge, though, is enforcement. Again, it's monitoring. It's more of the institutional side of things. Every case study out there is, of course, couched in its own political economy, its own political context. And so it's very, very difficult to actually tease out common benchmarks for regulatory reform. And so I think, right now, at least amongst the academic community, I think there's research coming out, but still we're still a long ways from coming to best practices and lessons learned on the regulation side of things. And this sort of dovetails into something I just want to leave you with. This session is about America's role in the global water crisis. And again, if I take off my World Bank hat and just speak as an American, I think clearly the U.S. has a lot to offer on the what. Okay, what technologies exist, how, you know, whether it's desalinization technologies, high efficiency technologies, advanced water treatment, so forth and so forth. I think the thing that America also has to offer is the how. Okay, and yes, there are challenges even here in the United States. Water is largely a state issue, and so, you know, it's perhaps one of the reasons why we don't have a national, functioning national water policy. But there are many, many good examples throughout this country, I think, that can serve as examples of how you do things. And let me just give you a very quick example. I took a delegation from the city of Chennai in India to, of all places, San Antonio, Texas. Okay. Now, the vegetarian options were limited, but the art of the possible was boundless. Okay. And what I mean is if you look at San Antonio, which has the San Antonio River, you look at Chennai, which has the Kum River, it's actually called the Kum River. A river is actually very generous because it's actually more like a sewer than an actual river. But 50 years earlier, San Antonio, the river there essentially looked and smelled like what the Kum does today. And so we took a delegation from the city. This included the wastewater treatment operators, the municipality officials, so forth and so forth, to look at the banks of the San Antonio. What they saw was a thriving economy all along the banks of the river. Okay, people want to live along the river in San Antonio. Okay, and that's not true in the Kum. And so what our discussions started off with, okay, well, how did this happen? How did you manage the differing interests, the differing stakeholders, the conflicting interests? How did you get key reforms and legislation passed through here? These types of questions are what I think the developing world is looking for, and I think the United States has a lot to offer in those regards. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Winston. Jim?
I'm struck very much by this question of how do you, well, and I think your comments about the riverbank in San Antonio. You need to have developers. You need to have environmentalists. You need to have water supply folks. You need to have health folks talking together. And I think in general, this is an area that's enormously important going forward in this administration and subsequent administrations. Those who are grappling with how we need to take a new look at the National Security Act, our structures for bringing people together within the U.S. government around cross-cutting issues like water are not all that good. I mean, we developed structures that worked quite well in the post-World War II Cold War era, so I think this is an area that we probably should have a three-day workshop on rather than a three-minute summation. But I do think the Paul Simon Act gets us started, at least in the water area, in the right direction by creating an office within AID and then a coordinator within the State Department so that you've got folks talking to each other. The risk is, and let me speak frankly because we're among friends here, the risk is if you're the USAID mission director in Malawi, you don't want someone, a coordinator, an AIDS coordinator telling you it's AIDS, and then a water coordinator telling you it's water, and then a somebody else coordinator telling... Ultimately, the reason we put ambassadors and we put aid mission directors out in these countries is so that they can look around and see what the local people think they need and what the priorities are locally. So that what we've got to do is take the gains that have been made under the Paul Simon Act and then generalize our ability to do better integrated policy. And I think that's an area that's far beyond the scope of even what the Center for Strategic and International Studies has organized here today. Steve, if you would indulge in just for 30 more seconds, I think the two topics that maybe we didn't talk very much about today that I think are critically important. Steve mentioned that this is kind of a quiet crisis, but there are places around the world, the Litani Basin along the Lebanese-Israeli border, Tigris-Euphrates Basin, which has a risk of conflict among Syria, Iraq, Turkey, the Indus Basin, where you have the potential of shooting wars over water. So that, again, this is an area where the U.S. government needs diplomatically to be looking over the horizon, doing strategic planning, and trying to head off potential conflict. And then finally, we didn't talk a lot about regionalization, but many of these, obviously, water basins do not respect national boundaries. Aquifers do not respect national boundaries. And this is an area where diplomatically we've got to do a lot better. One of the reforms we're trying to push through at USAID is more of a regional approach in general to problems of development, whether it's electrical supply grids or water basins. And I think the whole area of regionalization is critically important to moving this discussion forward. I want to thank Center for Strategic and International Studies for pulling this together.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to again thank Sarah Handy and Karen Meacham from CSI, Sarah Handy from Senator Durbin's office, for really pulling all of this together. I want to thank Patty for being with us today. I want to thank Senator Simon for his legacy that lives on here today. Senator Durbin for carrying the leadership on this, along with Representative Blumenauer, and Senators Murray and Corker for joining ranks. And I want to close by just thanking all of you for being here, and for our panelists, for Eric, Winston, and Jim, for what I think is a very forward-looking and rich discussion here today. So please join me in thanking them.